I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
I'm humbled by what has happened, and I renew my wholehearted apology for the gathering in the cabinet room on the 19th of June, 2020.
I can't say whether he'll be prime minister going into 2023, but I don't think that he will lead the party into the next general election.
Why does the prime minister think everybody else's actions have consequences except his own?
You're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepker. On today's programme, we're going to speak to the Conservative MP Jake Berry as controversy continues over the resignation of the Deputy Chief Whip, Chris Pincher. How serious is the damage to Boris Johnson's leadership?
And we'll be talking to Emma Reynolds from the financial industry group The City UK ahead of Rishi Sunak's Mansion House speech later this month. Will the Chancellor usher in a new boom for the city with the Financial Services and Markets Bill?
But first, the Prime Minister's spokesman says that Boris Johnson was aware of media reports and speculation about the MP Chris Pincher's alleged sexual misconduct, but promoted him to Deputy Chief Whip anyway, as no formal complaint had been made against him. Johnson suspended Pincher from the Conservative Party after fresh allegations on Friday. Labour's Emily Thornberry says there are conflicting signals coming from Downing Street.
They tell us different things on different days. That's the problem. And as time goes on, the truth starts to come out. And now we have a civil servant who's furious about the way in which they have been telling lies.
So, Emily Thornberry there. Well, this latest scandal adds to the pressure on the Prime Minister, no doubt, who only recently survived a bruising confidence vote of his own MPs.
Meanwhile, Keir Starmer has finally said the dreaded B word, Brexit.
We've got to make Brexit work. And that means going forwards, not backwards. So there's no case for reopening all those divisions, no case for going back in, for the single market, the customs union or freedom of movement. That would be to go backwards. We need to go forwards with a better deal that unblocks the blockages that are there, allows us to trade more successfully and grows our economy, because 12 years of stagnation have led to the economy we've got now with low wages but high prices.
Keir Starmer was speaking to the Centre for European Reform think tank on Monday evening, the Labour leader vowing to sort out what he called Johnson's poor deal. Starmer said that Labour would remove EU trade barriers and resolve issues over Northern Ireland, but that a Labour government wouldn't take the UK back into the EU's customs union or single market. Brexit has been a thorny issue for Labour since the 2016 referendum, with supporters divided over staying in or leaving the EU.
And just lastly, the government plans to force owners of social media and search apps to curb what it describes as state-linked disinformation or face fines. The government says that owners of platforms where people can post their own content will have a legal duty to curtail messages backed by foreign countries. The regulator Ofcom could impose fines of up to 10% of the company's annual global sales under the forthcoming online safety bill.
Well, let's discuss today's big issues now with our first guest, Jake Berry, Conservative MP for Rossendale and Darwin in Lancashire. Thank you very much for being with us, Jake. Let's talk then about the events surrounding Chris Pincher. Was Boris Johnson right to give him that job if he knew that there were issues around misconduct?
Well, I mean, I can't get into the Prime Minister's mindset. I'm a backbench MP. I'm not responsible for appointing ministers. Well, what I would say is this, and I think we've got to be really careful how we deal with this issue. It needs to be dealt with sensitivity, because I think this sort of this trial by media, and I know you guys have got your job to do, I think this trial by media, we're sort of losing sight of the victims in this process. And I think it's very, very difficult for those victims to see this process going on in the media. There is, of course, a formal process, which is now in full flow, both in Parliament and potentially with the police. And I think actually giving a bit of space for that process to happen and just having in our minds when we're talking about this, the victims here, I think is much more important than the sort of he said, she said of party politics.
Okay, but the reason that this is happening is that the system for dealing with victims is clearly so poor. I mean, if there were, concerns around misconduct and somebody was still able to get into a much more senior position, that is why there is such a great deal of concern. And the concern is around an ingrained pattern of sexual misconduct by Conservative MPs that is dealt with internally, in-house.
No, I think that's a really valid point. And of course, this isn't something that just affects the Conservative Party. You've seen the SNP former chief whip just be suspended from Parliament recently in relation to similar allegations. I think it's really deeply concerning that we have people working both in Parliament and in the civil service who feel that there isn't a proper process in place. We have previously attempted, when Andrea Leadsom was leader of the House, to put a new process in place. I think this is one of the first times that it will have being used. I think we really need to ask ourselves questions about what it is about this workplace environment that makes people, who've been subject to criminal acts, allegedly, to feel that they can't come forward and make their case. And I've got three young kids, and they're very young, my kids. But when they got a bit older, if they were going to come and work in Parliament for any reason, I'd want to know as a parent that it was a safe space for them to come to work. And I don't think we can say that at the moment.
There is now an awful lot of focus about what Boris Johnson knew and when, and that is damaging to him. We're looking at 1922 committee elections next week. Do you think that there could be another confidence vote on the cards if the rules are changed?
No, I mean, that's. I don't know who's going to be elected. We don't yet know who's being put up, but clearly there are people who are standing on a ticket saying that they want to change the rules. I personally won't be supporting them. I think, enabling prime ministers to have a 12-month hiatus in which they can get back to the main business of governing this country, delivering on our election promises, and not being a sort of, perma leadership election is the right thing to do. So those people who come out, who are standing on that ticket, if we want to change the rules, they're not people I'll be supporting.
Okay, but the pressure on Boris Johnson is surely enormous. I mean, this is scandal after scandal. There have been two by-elections for the Conservatives because of very serious sexual misconduct allegations. This is yet another. I mean, these are serious challenges to Boris Johnson's leadership. He scraped through a confidence vote. He surely is not going to be taking the Conservatives through to the next general election.
Look, my view is that he absolutely can and should take us through to the next election. I don't think, as terrible as these allegations are, and I share the concern that people rightly have about whether Parliament or the civil service is a safe place to work, just like any workplace, right? No one should feel that they're going to be subject to harassment of any kind or discrimination of any kind in any workplace. Parliament shouldn't be, some place out on its own. I think that actually when I talk to my constituents in Lancashire and in Rossendale and Darwin, what they really want us to be focused on is what we were elected to do, which is changing the life chances of people through this levelling up agenda in Lancashire and beyond. And people want us to focus on
that. So, Jake, you have no doubts about the judgment of the Prime Minister in appointing this individual who there were clearly allegations of misconduct with him before, that you have no issues with the judgment of the Prime Minister of elevating him to the position?
I don't know what the allegations are, but I've been really clear, haven't I? There is a process. I think the right thing to do, which may involve criminal sanctions, I think rather than this sort of running commentary on it, which I think does a disservice to the victims, actually, which is my main concern, it is right to let that process, that process play out.
Looking at then the issue of cost of living, which you say is more important to people that you speak to than what's happening to Boris Johnson, what should the government be doing more than they have already? We're talking about a new fuel price record, go slow protests on motorways. Does the government need to slash VAT on fuel?
Well, the government absolutely needs to do more. Let's give credit where credit's due. £30 billion plus is not a small amount of money. And I know my constituents and people up and down this country will be grateful for the £400 money off their fuel. They'll be grateful for up to £1,200 for people on lower incomes. But I think the government does have to do more. And I think the only place the government can go next is tax cuts. I filled my wife's car full of diesel at the weekend. It was over £100 to fill the tank. She'll be doing that once a week. because she has to go to work and get the kids around. That is unsustainable. And it is now time, I think, for the government to get back to its main job of putting money back in people's pockets. And the only way the government can do that, in my view, is by cutting taxes. And that's why I hope that we will hear from the government very shortly about a VAT cut, a fuel duty cut, whatever it may be. But unless we bring those prices down at the pumps, it's going to cripple our economy.
Okay, so in favour of a VAT tax cut then. The Resolution Foundation warned on Monday that the poorest families in the UK are vulnerable to this cost of living crunch because of two decades of income stagnation. They blamed it effectively in large part on the basic unemployment support being so low, benefits being so low that they've fallen 13% to 13% of average pay, so basically a record low. Was it a mistake to pull back the £20 per week uplift for benefits?
Well, my view is that, you know, if we knew then what we knew now, we probably would have kept it in place. So you can't know what you don't know. But there's clearly an issue, isn't there, with the individual inflation. So while we say inflation is 9, 10 or 11%, whatever it may be, that is different for different people. And those on the lowest income feel the biggest, you know, price rises because their shopping and their fuel, whether that be in their vehicle or at home, takes up a bigger proportion of their income. So, you know, doing something on VAT, on fuel, is something absolutely that I think is the right thing to do. In fact, the poorest families in this country pay the largest proportion of their income in VAT. So if we cut that, in my view, preferably across the board, it gives the biggest break in terms of incomes to people on lower wages. And that's why, as a Conservative, I think what we should be doing is enabling people to keep more of their own money in the first place to help deal with some of these costs that they're being hit by.
Briefly, if you would, we're looking at more strikes. Royal Mail, the latest on the list of, you know, big companies that are going on strike. Should the government be intervening?
Well, you know, each one is different, isn't it? But I do think there is always a role for the government to be a sort of fair broker and knock people's heads together. The Royal Mail is a private company, to a large extent owned by its workforce, so it's for the company to set its own terms and conditions.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
And now, let's turn our attention to the issues facing the financial sector here in London. Joining us now is Emma Reynolds, who's Managing Director of Public Affairs, Policy and Research at the industry group, the City UK, also a former Labour MP. Emma, welcome to the programme. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, recently, the
Morning.
City UK...
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Recently, the City UK hosted Treasury Minister John Glenn, the Economy Secretary. Thank you so much for telling us a little bit more about it. We're looking at this very, very tight labour market in the UK at the moment. How are employers in the financial services being affected and sort of bearing up to this?
Well, the financial and related professional services industry is... you know, experiencing the same pressures that the rest of the economy is. But I would say I think it's particularly acute for us because financial services is all about ideas and talent and, you know, global innovation. So actually we need access to talent. And one of the things that we've done in recent years, because we knew this would be an issue and continues to be an issue, is we set up the Financial Services Skills Commission, which is looking at how we attract talent that's already in the UK and make sure, you know, new talent coming up isn't going to other industries. More and more the younger population is looking at flexibility and a sense of purpose. I think COVID has changed the equation for a lot of people. And we know that a lot of people in their 50s have left the market. So it is a tight market. And then we're also doing some work around how we can ensure that financial and related professional services firms upskill and reskill their current workforce, and that can actually save them a great deal of money. And then thirdly, One of the things that obviously is politically more sensitive is the immigration system and the access to international talent, which is absolutely key for our industry, because there are skills out there that we can't cater for domestically, that we will need to bring in, whether it's sometimes it's on a short-term basis, very often it's on a short-term basis, knowledge of different markets around the world. Our industry is truly global, so we need to do that. And we've been doing some work with the government and trying to ensure that the frictions that we see for visas are brought down and the costs, and also looking at a sponsorship route for short-term mobility, so intercompany transferees, actually not having to have a visa for periods of up to sort of 6 to 12 months.
Okay, we'll come back to the visa issue for a second. I'm interested in, as you described, the lengths that employers are going to attract new workers. Is that pushing up pay, and by how much?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I think that will be dependent on the firm, dependent on the sector of the industry, because financial services and related professional services, there's a whole ecosystem that we're working with. But obviously, people will be looking at their pay. They will be looking at inflation. We know there's a lot of movement between firms. That's a sort of factor of the economy overall. So actually, you talk to HR people in firms or even in our own business, and it's sort of a candidate's market out there. So they do have a bit of bidding power. So, yes, I think that there will be pressure on wages. Of course, there will, because people's cost of living has gone up, skyrocketed, and it is about to get even worse come the autumn.
Yeah. So that on employment, on hiring, on wages. But the main focus really for the city is the fact that the City of London is largely isolated, cut off from the EU post-Brexit. And the government is having to come up with some plans to support this industry that is a major taxpayer and a huge employer. One of those is the bit of legislation that's coming to reform insurance and capital markets. Is the government, in your view, actually listening now? I mean, during the Brexit process, most observers sort of came away with the conclusion that the government had other priorities and it really wasn't the financial services sector.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'd just say, I know everybody likes to say the City of London, but 2.2 million people are employed in our industry across the whole ecosystem, and actually two-thirds of them are based outside of London. London is absolutely crucial to that, because it underpins the jobs that you see in other financial centres around the country, in Birmingham, Leeds, Manchester, Glasgow, Edinburgh. But I just wanted to make that point from the outset. Is the government listening? I think the government is listening, and John Glenn is a fantastic economic secretary to the Treasury, the longest serving, 4.5 years. I think some of the others didn't survive in post that long. It's great to have him there in post. And they have done extensive consultation with our industry since the end of the transition period. And so we are looking at what we need to do, I think, and what the government needs to make sure it does. And I'm looking forward to seeing the new Financial Services and Markets Bill, which we're expecting in a couple of weeks, is for us to really exploit the agility and nimbleness that we now have. Because when we were in the EU, we had to agree all these rules and regulations with 27 other member states. Now we're just one country regulating for the UK market. So the government has an opportunity to tailor its regulation for our industry.
But and this opportunity, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Emma, but I'm going to cut to the chase, which is that this opportunity has been known for some years. The question remains, how?
Well, there are all sorts of things that the government can do and is doing. It's reviewing a number of key pieces of legislation. But without going into the details of that, one thing that I think we need to do, and the government is looking to do with this bill, is to introduce a new statutory objective of international competitiveness and economic growth for our regulators, because we are in a competitive environment. You've talked about us no longer being a gateway to the European Union. That's absolutely the case. That's the consequence of Brexit. But actually, the competitive headwinds are coming from the US and financial centres further east as well, in Asia and elsewhere. So competitiveness is our key focus. And access to talent and the right regulation But when you talk to our financial services firms, they are two key issues that we've got to get right in order to remain competitive. We're confident, but we're not complacent about this. And we'd like to be on the top spot again. New York is now the leading international financial center. We'd like London and the UK to become number one again. And we set out a strategy as to how to do that. And one of the things we need to do is be at the cutting edge of these new growth industries of fintech, and the whole agenda around ESG and green. We need to be really at the cutting edge of those those new growth areas.
There are also, there's an importance too that relations with the EU remain good, because there are equivalence deals, although not very many of them, that do affect financial services and hang kind of quite a delicate balance for your industry. And I'm wondering, how do you worry when you see things blowing up over the Northern Ireland Protocol, for example, that that could actually end up having a backfire effect on financial services?
Well, we've already seen that happen. Alongside the trade and cooperation agreement, which was agreed between the UK and the EU, there was a commitment to negotiate a memorandum of understanding on financial services, which was essentially to set up a regular dialogue between the Treasury here and its equivalent in the European Commission. Now, the technical negotiations for that went well, but it hit a political roadblock. And obviously the Northern Ireland Protocol is the main part of that. So until the politicians sort that out, that has been blocked. And I know that other things are blocked for other industries. When it comes to equivalence, we are not expecting the EU to grant further equivalence, but we are glad that we have this clearing equivalence, which I think, frankly, is good for the EU and good for the UK. But I wanted to say that, you know, financial services firms did a great job and spent a lot of money and a lot of time preparing for the end of the transition, and now also getting around the fact that we haven't got equivalence in many areas, and we're not expecting it, to be frank.
Emma, we have talked a lot, and we're thinking a lot, of course, about the war in Ukraine, about the relations, Western relations with Russia, with China. When I hear the word competitiveness, there is a concern, surely, that that competitiveness clashes with national security priorities for Britain and with issues that London undoubtedly has with money laundering and issues of dirty money from Russia and influence, for example, from China. Is that, how do you think about that?
Well, financial services firms have been on the front line when it comes to implementing sanctions. And, you know, absolutely right. And we are not complaining about that, by the way. We totally understand and join with the government in condemning the illegal invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and have put a lot of work into complying and with the sanctions. And that sounds like an easy thing to do. It isn't. You've got to apply for licenses, you've got to do all sorts of things and get those things right and make sure that the money then doesn't get transferred into the wrong hands in Russia, by the way, so we don't end up enriching the regime there. So I don't think what we've just been talking about is in contradiction to that effort. But I do think one of the things that we are fearful of is that there's some kind of contagion effect from Russia. I think the industry absolutely understands that in this circumstance, economic sanctions were rightly imposed and were wide reaching. But we don't want to see a contagion to other markets, because our industry is global and it can only operate if we have free and open global markets, and as free as possible, frankly, and as open as possible. And the UK has always been a champion of open global markets, and I hope that we continue to be that champion and that we don't see there's all sorts of phrases that people talk about, but essentially a fragmentation and breakdown of global markets, because that wouldn't be in anyone's interest. And that's not just from a firm's perspective, by the way, that's from an investor and customer perspective, because actually you need competition to have better products and to bring costs down.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.